Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on our website 98.9fm.com.au or on our podcast a bit later, welcome to you as well. It's really good to have your company here, and we're going to be talking about issue close to my heart, and it's going to be around sort of these huge rising numbers of the black jailing rates that continue to go up and up and that don't seem to be slowing. And I think it's really the greatest injustice facing a lot of Aboriginal people across the country today, and it's one that we're no closer to solving. But we're looking at it from a different perspective today, and it's a perspective that isn't talked about, but which is incredibly important. And we're talking about it with a young Yorta Yorta woman, a public health professional, Summer May Finley. Good morning, Summer. How are you this morning?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you here. First of all, I wanted to ask, where's your mob and where's your country?
Yeah, so I'm a Yorta Yorta woman, but I grew up on Lake Macquarie, which is beautiful Aboriginal country.
So that's a bit of a far away from home, isn't it?
It is, it is. My grandmother came up here in the 50s, so I've got a lot of family up here and a lot of family down on country too.
Do you ever go back to Yorta Yorta country, visit that place?
Not as much as I like. Most of the time I seem to go back to funerals, which I think is what most of our mob seem to do when they're not on country.
Yeah, very sad. A very sad part of our life today, I think, and one that sort of turns, it's sort of the human face to the statistics, isn't it, when you talk about closing the gap and the horrendous life expectancy rates.
Yeah, absolutely. I was looking the other day at some statistics again for another purpose, and, you know, I saw that only 3% of Aboriginal people are over the age of 65, which is just less than 15,000, which is pretty devastating.
Yeah, right. First of all, I just wanted to ask you, how did you get into sort of the public health arena? Why did you decide to sort of devote your life to researching public health?
It kind of happened by default. I kind of fell into it and then realised how much I loved it. So, I mean, I'm doing a PhD at the moment, and if you'd asked me 15 years ago if I'd be doing a PhD, the answer would have been hell no. I went to school, I did all right. I went to uni, I dropped out though after a year, and I ended up doing a Bachelor of Social Science and I majored in linguistics. I actually wanted to do research in Aboriginal languages. Couldn't find a job in that, and I ended up finding a job in Aboriginal health research.
Right.
So I figured it ticked three of my boxes. So I figured, you know, might as well just do that. And then I fell in love with health and realised that, you know, this is something that made sense to me, and ended up doing a Master of Public Health. And, yeah, so I had a lot of amazing people, Aboriginal women in particular, around me that really showed me what you could do in public health and the impact it could have on Aboriginal people's lives. So I guess, I kind of fell into it, and I'm really grateful that I did.
When you talk about being very passionate with Aboriginal languages and wanting to revitalise that, I mean, that would have a public health impact as well, wouldn't it? Getting back to culture and country, there would be evidence sort of linking that to sort of public health, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why I really like public health, and particularly when you think about it from the Aboriginal perspective, which is looking at more than just the absence of disease, which actually looks at the social, the community, the cultural health, all of those aspects actually play into our health. So I think that's why public health really suits me, because I can see that there are so many things that I'm passionate about, like you said, language, that really does impact on our health. And, you know, I didn't grow up on country. My grandmother died before I was born, and I don't know language particularly well, and I feel like I've lost something because of that, and I know a lot of our mob do, and that's why I was passionate about language, is because language is so intimately linked to culture. But having said that, there are other people that are working on that, and, you know, the work that I do, hopefully together we can, you know, do something that's better.
You talked about falling into public health. How did you actually fall into it? I mean, where did you sort of get your grounding, your foundation when you began this career?
Well, I went to uni a bit later at ripe old age of 23. They considered me a mature age student. I don't know how mature I was.
That makes me feel really old.
But that was, yeah, when I was 23. So that was a while ago now. But so I did social science, really. And social science is not dissimilar to public health because it looks at the way society functions and the impact on society. So you do things like gender studies, you do things like... you know, I did bilingual education, which looked at how, you know, that actually can be really important for people from a bilingual background and the impact that'll have on their self-esteem and a whole range of things. So social science and public health have a lot of commonalities. So when I moved into public health, I saw this as something that was not dissimilar.
Yeah, right. So really important. And where did you actually start working at? Because I know you've been around at a few different organisations.
Yeah, I have. So I started working at a mainstream health clinic and that didn't work out so well for me. So I ended up working at the Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation,
which is
the peak Aboriginal health body in Victoria. And I've worked at a couple of those orgs since. So I've predominantly worked in Aboriginal Community Controlled Health or Aboriginal Community Control.
And what would you say is the main differences towards approaches from mainstream health services to Aboriginal Community Control services?
Community control for me is the main difference is two things. Is one, it's they look at the person and they look at what that person needs rather than, you know, looking at just the physical health. So there's some of our services that will offer financial counselling. They'll be working with docs or whatever they're called now. I can't remember here in New South Wales. So they actually look at a person and their family and go, what services can we supply you? Where most mainstream services really only look at physical health and they may also look at mental health as well. And the other thing is that each ACCHO really is in touch with their community and they really look at the services that community needs and work at making sure they're doing that rather than looking at it as a business model.
Yeah, and when you look at the cuts to community-controlled health services, you just see how dire and atrocious it could be to sort of the future of ourselves as a people when you look at just how important they are and what role they play in the community.
Absolutely. Like, they're pretty lean services as it is, so to be making cuts is pretty challenging.
Now, you write a lot for the website Croaky. I'm wondering how you got into sort of the media. I mean, you went from linguistics to public health and now you're quite passionate as sort of a communicator for public health and for Aboriginal health in general. How did that begin?
I got angry is how it really is. I've always liked writing, to be honest. I actually wanted to be a journalist and wrote for the school newspaper. And then I realised how bloody difficult it is. So I think people like you who have devoted their lives to it, you know, have done some amazing stuff. And I actually met Melissa Sweet on Twitter and we happened to be tweeting at the same event and she ran out and met me in person. So, and that's how I got started with, you know, Croaky. I just had a conversation with Melissa and then I got angry about Tony Abbott being the Minister for Indigenous Affairs and the issues that were happening at the time around the first budget and wrote a piece and I said to Melissa, if it's really bad, please don't publish it. But that's how it kind of started and I guess I don't feel like our issues get spoken about enough, that we have a lot of non-Aboriginal people who write about our stuff who don't understand some of the complexities or don't have the time to understand, particularly with things like Fairfax getting journalists getting cut and things like that. So I just started writing because, I just wanted to see a bit more balance in the conversations.
And it's interesting. I mean, I was reading one of the articles you have written for Croaky and it's a really interesting article because it actually poses that question, tying media to health journal to the health of our people and is the media making us sick? And it's a really important question because you look at the mainstream media and their continual negative reportage or just the way they focus on certain issues, like you've raised the point of risky drinking, for example, and how that's put in, you know, against the actual statistics that show that Aboriginal people drink less than non-Indigenous Australians. I mean, that's a really important question. Is the media actually making us more sick?
It definitely continues to perpetrate stereotypes of our mob, and I think that it definitely has a role to play in either helping or hurting us. So I actually did a project for my advanced master's, which was 12 months of research looking at a comparison between the way media report Aboriginal alcohol consumption and other Australians' alcohol consumption.
Right.
And so I found that the way it was reporting Aboriginal consumption was very different than mainstream.
Was it in the way that they use language, for example, like the way they might call a blackfella drunken or use the word grog, or what sort of ways did you see that the difference in reporting between the two?
The time I was actually looking at this was when the coward punches legislation was being discussed, and also when the Nigel Scullion announced the alcohol inquiry into Aboriginal communities. So there was a lot of discussion on both sides. And what I found actually was that it was Aboriginal people were the problem.
Oh, right. And
it was Aboriginal people. And so it was individuals, whereas when they actually discussed things like the coward punches, what it was that young people had access to alcohol, so we need to reduce the hours. So they actually considered the system to be the problem rather than it being a cultural issue of young people, but it was a cultural issue of Aboriginal people.
That's incredibly racist when you consider that they would sort of, report it so sensitively when it's a non-Indigenous person, but Aboriginal people just happen to be these others who can't handle their grog, who have these innate problems that, they have a personal responsibility to overcome. I mean, that's a real example of racism in the media that not a lot of non-Indigenous Australians can actually see. I mean, to me, it's just that pure racism that sort of seeps into every single part of reporting in Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the sad part about it is most mainstream journalists that are writing like that actually don't understand what they're doing, because it's just the way things have always been done.
Yeah, right. And how do you think it impacts on us as a people? I mean, I can imagine the psychological impacts, but are there impacts to sort of physical health reading these really horrendous things about our people in relation to health and poor health?
Yeah, so there is. Lowitch has put out some studies around mental health and racism, and has linked poor mental health with racism. We also know that mental health is linked to physical health, so it's not it is obviously going to have physical impacts on our health and our well-being. And I mean, even me, and I think, I don't know if you feel this sometimes as well, but I read stuff and I feel physically sick, and you go, why do I do this? I can't make a difference. And you actually feel very lost and hurt. Well, I do. And I kind of, sometimes it stresses me out to the point where I need to just have a couple of days out and not read anything.
Yeah, right. I mean, I had that similar reaction to the recent reportage around the suicide of the 10-year-old girl. I don't know if you had that same feeling, but when I read just the outrage that, and it was good. I'm glad that people were paying attention to this really horrendous tragedy that happened in a community. But I just felt really lost in the sense that it happens all the time. A couple of years ago, we were talking about the same issue, young children committing suicide in remote communities. And it's just as if there's this outrage one day and then people move on. And I had a really strong reaction to that. I just wanted to turn off media completely. I don't know if you had a similar reaction, but that's just one example, the suicide crisis in our communities.
Yeah, I actually stopped reading stuff.
Yeah.
Because I think almost every Aboriginal person knows someone that has either attempted suicide, discussed suicide, or been successful. And I think that it actually hits really close to home to us, and we feel it. And the outrage that we see in the media is fantastic, but it needs to be sustained.
Yeah.
And it needs to have, political will behind it to actually stop this from happening.
You've been very active in trying to reverse a lot of the problems around mainstream reportage through your work, through Crokey. But I'm just wondering, what responsibility do you think the mainstream media have to try and understand these issues? Because it's been very long that they've been perpetuating this negative sort of coverage, and it doesn't seem like anything's going to change. And you mentioned the cuts to Fairfax as well. So as newspapers get leaner and leaner, it's going to get worse. Do you have any sort of ideas about where mainstream media should go? Are they sort of just a lost cause? We have to build up our alternative media.
I think by building up our alternative media, we will put pressure on mainstream media to do better. because they are commercial businesses and they will actually need to. I don't think anyone is a lost cause. I think some are more lost than others. But I wouldn't say they're a complete lost cause. But, I mean, the first thing I'd like to say to mainstream media outlets is, please, if you're going to use Indigenous, capitalise it.
Yeah.
Like, I know that sounds silly and basic, but, you know, we're a proper noun.
Well, an Australian is an Australian, it's capitalised. So It's really interesting.
And some of them actually do. And I have to say, with Melissa Sweet from Croke and a number of other people, we've been advocating behind the scenes for different media outlets to actually get them to refer to us as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples or Indigenous and to capitalise it. And some have come to the party and some are completely resistant, which really shows their disrespect towards Aboriginal people.
Do they have any explanation for being resistant? I'm just wondering, because it does seem like such a simple thing you can do as just a first step forward.
They say it's not grammatically correct because obviously grammatical correctness is more important than what we call ourselves.
I mean, that's just stupid to me because I can pick up a newspaper and see so many errors in grammar every single day. I find that really amazing.
I just think it is a lack of respect and a lack of willingness to make change. But for the organisations that have made change, that is fantastic. And I think what it really is they need to actually employ dedicated people to work in Aboriginal affairs.
Yeah.
I know I've been told, and I'm assuming it's the truth, that ABC, for example, doesn't have a Aboriginal dedicated reporter, yet they'll have a political reporter.
Yeah, right. I mean, The Australian, I know The Australian's got an Indigenous affairs editor now. The Guardian does as well, but those are only two outlets. You would think the ABC would have a whole newsroom full of them.
Yeah. Look, and again, I apologise if what I've been told is not the truth, but I would encourage all news outlets to actually take Aboriginal affairs seriously and have dedicated reporters because the issues are complex and you can't do justice to articles to our mob with superficial articles.
Yeah, that's very true. What I wanted to talk to you next about was a really important initiative Croke has actually begun. And just for our listeners as well, Croke sort of, it was a blog that was started on the independent website Crikey, and it's sort of just grown into this whole other website, which is focused largely on really socially responsible health journalism. But one of the focuses of late has been on Indigenous affairs, Indigenous incarceration, and it's not something that you would immediately tie to health journalism. Why was there an important need for this focus on Indigenous incarceration from a health focus, did you think?
I think... Again, looking at the broader definition of health, anything and everything that impacts on our lives is going to impact on our health and health being physical, social, community, cultural, and social and emotional well-being health. And, I mean, if you're ripping someone out of the community and throwing them in jail and you're isolating them, that's going to have an impact on their physical health, their social and emotional, their community, and also their mental health. So I think for me, it was quite an obvious fit that you are right. For a lot of people who think about health from a physical point of view only, it probably doesn't seem to fit as well.
So the campaign is, can you tell us a bit about the campaign? Because it's called Just Justice. I mean, where did it start? How is it being funded? Where can people access it?
So the campaign kind of started quite organically. It came out of some conversations with Mick Gooder and Tom Calmer. So Mick Gooder being the current Social Justice Commissioner and Tom Calmer being a previous Social Justice Commissioner and also wears both and wear many other hats, with Melissa Sweet. And Melissa mentioned to me the conversation and it kind of snowballed from there. And to be honest with you, it just got a life of its own. And we ended up crowdfunding to the series of articles, which was absolutely fantastic. And I have to say the crowdfunding was so heartening because we had two quite large donations, one from an individual and one from the Jesuit Society. And the rest were small donations from individual people. So individual Australians were actually showing us, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, that this was an issue for them. So that was quite encouraging. So we actually spent the long weekend tweeting like mad because we had 3 days to raise $10,000 and we didn't think we were going to get there, but we did. And so since then, and that was in the Easter long weekend, so it's almost been going for 12 months, We've written about 50 articles on the issue of over-incarceration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And I should also say that I'm only one of the people that are involved in the Just Justice team. So we've got Melissa Sweet from Crokey, Mari McInerney, who's also from Crokey and does other amazing stuff, Mitchell Ward, he works for Crokey and also does some other stuff as well, and Megan Williams. So, you know, we've got quite a great team, and Nick and Tom have been very supportive along the way as well.
And you mentioned you were tweeting like mad. I mean, we were talking about mainstream media. What benefit has sort of social media been to the campaign and also just the messages you're hoping to promote?
Well, Aboriginal people are great at yarning, and Twitter's just been another yarning tool. It's amazing to see how many of our mob are on there. And so we've kind of built up this network, I feel, around Just Justice and other issues where Aboriginal people can support and non-Aboriginal people can support. So we're actually, I feel like it's an opportunity to have our voices privileged in a way that mainstream media doesn't, because it's quite closed shop.
Yeah, right. Do you think like an initiative like this could have happened without that social media being able to raise that amount of money?
I don't think so. And I think that to raise the amount of money that we did, we probably would have had to spend a lot more time to actually do it.
Yeah.
So social media has certainly made it easier for us to communicate to people all around the country.
That's awesome. And we'll put the details up about Just Justice on our website as well, but we might go to a break. And I think when we come back, hoping to talk about some of the issues that you actually raise in a lot of the articles, a lot of the public health issues that are really important and are tied to the sort of growing incarceration crisis. So I'll keep you on the line and we'll come back after the break. Here's a bit of Sharon Lane, Something You Said.
You're listening to Let's Talk, presenting issues affecting the First Peoples of our country. Here's Amy McQuire.
Good morning and welcome back to Let's Talk. Our guest for this morning is Yorta Yorta writer and public health professional Summer May Finlay, and we're talking about specifically about Just Justice, which is a project of the health website Crokey, specifically looking at the rising Indigenous incarceration crisis from a health perspective, which is something we don't really look at when we actually report on Aboriginal incarceration and criminology and everything like that. So it's a really important project. And Summer, we were talking a bit in the break about sort of the issues that are really close to your heart. And one of those issues is youth. And we know that we're locking up more and more Aboriginal children. You know, and you look at particularly the child removal rates as well, and how that sort of is paving the way for these rising juvenile incarceration rates. I mean, as a public health professional, why are you so passionate about looking at youth and the health impacts this have on our next generations?
Oh, I mean, to start with, just to give people some context, half of all juveniles incarcerated are Aboriginal.
Yeah, and that's national, isn't it? That's a national figure.
That's national. So every state and territory is complicit in that. And we know that what happens to you as a young person is going to impact you for the rest of your life, impact your opportunities, your physical health, your social and emotional health, your education. And to think that we are locking kids up, we are restricting their ability to be the best they can be and who they want to be. And surely as a country that is as wealthy and as prosperous as Australia, we can come up with some better solutions than just locking kids up.
I definitely think that's true. I mean, when you look at specifically, I mean, you talked about their futures. It's really sad to think that, you know, through no fault of their own, Aboriginal kids, largely because they just sort of get caught in this really horrendous system that catches so many Aboriginal men, women and children. I mean, it's through no fault of your own. I mean, what sort of impacts on health specifically do you think that it has on children locking up so many kids?
And I think the most obvious one would be mental health. You know, we're going to have kids that are coming out with, you know, substantial mental health and social emotional well-being, and also cultural identity issues, where it is going to mean that they're going to struggle for the rest of their lives, which will then have a real effect on their physical health. I think, you know, the effects on their health are going to be so varied. We know we have huge rates of diabetes. We know we have issues with other chronic diseases as well. I mean, you've got tobacco consumption, which is through the roof too. Like, there's all of these things that'll have an impact on in sometimes a direct way and an indirect way. So I think it's hard to say specifically how it's going to have an impact, but we just know that it will. If that makes sense.
No, definitely. And I think when I talk about through no fault of their own, a lot of kids are actually in the system, caught in the system, because, you know, this rising problem around FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, isn't it? I mean, we don't even know the true statistics around that problem, and a lot of kids are in there because they've, you know, been sort of in an environment in the womb where they've been exposed to really harmful drinking when their mothers have been pregnant as well. So we're talking about a crisis around FASD as well. Is that something that you've been reporting on?
There has been an article that we published as part of Just Justice around FASD. I mean, FASD, we don't actually even class it as a disability at the moment in Australia. It's really hard to diagnose as well unless they're on the more extreme spectrum. And a lot of areas in, say, rural or remote Australia don't actually have the expertise to diagnose FASD. So we've got children that will have FASD who aren't actually known to have FASD. And so with FASD, they will actually have, you know, it's a spectrum, so it varies. But basically there is, you know, issues around self-control, mood control, a whole range of things which will then obviously impact on the way they behave. And some of those behaviours are going to be going to mean they come in contact with the justice system. I mean, we had an issue which recently, and over the last couple of years, Rosie Fulton, who was an Aboriginal woman who in WA and Northern Territory, who was locked up because of violent behaviour, and she has FASD, and we do not have a system which actually can support her in Australia other than putting her back in jail.
And then you look particularly at her case, but also in WA and the NT, where people are locked up, largely Aboriginal people too, are locked up who have mental disabilities, and there's no other place for them to go. So they're largely being locked up for having a disability, you know. I think it's we're at that stage too where we don't even have, we're warehousing people effectively who are the victims of society.
Absolutely. And that's something I think we need to remember as well, is that, you know, even though people who've got disabilities, people with FASD and other young people that might come in contact with the justice system, we need to remember the history and the political history that has actually disenfranchised Aboriginal people, which has been blatantly racist against Aboriginal people, which has ended up entrenching disadvantage and poverty within a lot of our communities. And then we're actually now seeing the results of that, which is young people being locked up, our mob with disabilities being locked up. And as Australia, we need to take responsibility for the stuff that's happened in the past and the impact that's having on our mob today, and actually go, we need to stop this before it gets worse. Because if we're locking kids up, you know, they're more likely to go back into the system. If they go back into the system, they're entrenching poverty and disadvantage.
And I guess that's why it's so important to have the media service that you're providing, because that context towards the past and the historical reasons is so fundamental to being able to solve this problem and educating people about the true nature of it. Do you think media as a whole is changing in relation to, particularly when you're looking at incarceration issues, about why we have these rising numbers? Because often you only see the statistics reported. There's no actual information or explanation of how we've gotten to this point. Do you think mainstream media are sort of changing in relation to that?
Look, I don't know if they're changing specifically in relation to incarceration, but I think they are changing in relation to other issues like health, for example, because of the closing the gap and also close the gap. I think, though, because the political will is still lock people up. You do the crime, you do the time.
There's a very law and order focus because it wins elections, really.
It does. I mean, it was an election platform here in New South Wales during the last election. People like the idea of safer communities and so of locking people up. But just the nice thing is the crime rate's been going down, yeah. but incarceration just generally has been going up.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that people need to get real about what's happening here and actually consider things like drug offences to be a social issue rather than a criminal issue.
I was just going to say, like, when you talk about people like the idea of safe communities, locking more and more people up, particularly, you know, disenfranchised people, people who have problems, people with disabilities, you know, it actually makes communities more less safe because you actually are sort of breeding more and more people to just basically put back into jail when you think about it, because it really does have a huge impact on mental health and your predisposition to alcohol and drugs, and that affects your children, and it's just this yep. chain effect. So it actually makes communities less safe when you think about it. It's just that handy political slogan, I guess, and blaming the blacks is a big part of that.
Absolutely. I mean, you've got election cycles which are quite short, where, you know, to address these issues is going to take potentially generations.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been around, we've had, when we were invaded, 200 and something years ago,
yeah.
taken this long to actually get to where we are, and we're just going downhill in some areas like incarceration. And it will take a long time to undo those issues. And unfortunately, I'm not sure that politicians see beyond the life of their term.
We're talking about election cycles, and we're actually coming up to one now. We're facing the prospect of a double dissolution election. Now, I think Liberals and Labor have been so close to, you know, so much in common between them on Aboriginal affairs policies. It's largely a matter of picking the one who's less evil. But do you think that Labor potentially might have a better case, or what do you see from both major parties in relation to justice issues specifically?
Liberals won't even really talk about the issue other than say they won't talk about the issue.
Yeah.
Labor is at least, Bill Shorten came out before the last election and around, I think it was in December last year and maybe earlier again this year, and actually reaffirmed his commitment to a justice target under closing the gap. And as we discussed before, health is a broader, health encompasses everything that affects us as an individual and as a community. And I think having a justice target would actually go a long way to improving the lives of Aboriginal people.
This has because I was just going to say, I mean, this has been something that's been called on from a number of organisations, a number of Aboriginal community-controlled organisations, justice organisations, but the Liberals just seem to be very, you know, they're just very resistant to the idea of justice targets. But do you think we could ever close the gap without lowering these Indigenous incarceration rates?
No. Because I think that they're a symptom of the larger issue, and they're the symptom of the underlying disadvantage. And without addressing the underlying disadvantage, you're not going to close the gap, and you're going to continue to see symptoms like high incarceration rates. And to be quite frank, Aboriginal organisations have been talking about this stuff for a long time. And, you know, again, this is a very personal view, but I don't believe that Liberal actually cares to listen to Aboriginal organisations. They have an agenda. Both political parties have an agenda, but at least Labor has been more likely to listen to Aboriginal organisations than the Liberals seem to be.
Well, I think the evidence is there in the IAS process, Indigenous Advancement Scheme, because we just saw last week just basically confirmation of what a lot of organisations around the country were saying about the IAS and all the funding that was pulled out from really important community-controlled services all around the country. I mean, the evidence is there. It's not even really an opinion. They haven't really delivered what they said they would deliver to Aboriginal people. And in fact, I think we have gone backwards recently, but yeah. I think we've been going backwards for a very long time. I mean, Close the Gap started under Rudd, and we're facing a widening gap. We're not closing it.
Yeah, in some areas we are widening. In other areas we have made some. It looks like we might be on target, so that's access to early childhood education. But it is one of those. The IAS is a prime example, and again, they talk about safe communities and what they've done, and that's one of the IAS, you know, focuses. Where have they invested in things? There is increased police. There's truancy officers for schools. But they haven't actually invested in long-term sustainable programs which will address the underlying issues. So, again, they're treating the solutions. And, you know, I fear what's going to happen is they will throw their hands up in the air and say, we tried, but we couldn't fix the Aboriginal problem.
Yeah, I think they can't. They have to be held accountable as well. I think there's a severe lack of accountability across all governments, state and federal, isn't there? I mean, wouldn't it be great if we had just some sort of mechanism? Because it's actually quite criminal when you consider that people are dying largely because of the neglect and the apathy of governments all around the country.
Absolutely, and that's why I'd like to see open data. So there's a woman on Twitter called Rosie Williams who is campaigning for open data, and I think that open data would actually allow other organisations to hold the government to account. And they, under the IAS, were actually saying that one of the reasons why they were doing the IAS was to reduce red tape and also hold organisations accountable for the public money. That public money is our money. Yeah. Why aren't they being held accountable for how they're spending our money?
Well, it's funny though, if it's an Aboriginal organisation misspending, you see a complete difference in the way that they're held accountable. You see a real difference in the way white organisations are held accountable to black organisations. I think that's the other problem as well.
Absolutely. And I know that, you know, for example, under the National Indigenous Reform Agreement, which is the formal agreement for closing the gap, that the NKPIs, which are the KPIs which are used to measure closing the gap and a whole range of other things, are actually only there for Aboriginal organisations.
Right.
They're not there for mainstream organisations. I'm actually doing my PhD on this particular topic.
Jeez.
And the fact that mainstream organisations get about 66% of all the Aboriginal health dollars, and yet they are not held to the same level of account as what Aboriginal organisations are. And the government clearly has very little accountability.
I mean, when you think of that, the differing KPIs, I mean, what does it say about the government's view of Aboriginal people and their ability and the real need to be self-determining and run our own futures? What sort of message do you think that sends?
It sends a message that we can't be trusted to take care of our own business.
Yeah.
And, you know, considering the government's been doing such a great job of taking care of us for the last 200 and something years... you know,
a sense of it is sarcasm.
Yes. Well, it's either that or I start swearing, but we're on radio, so I can't. But for me, and it goes back to justice issues as well, where is the accountability of both the state and the Commonwealth government to address these issues? I mean, we've got programs like Justice Reinvestment, which is happening in Bourke, Cowra, and they're also talking about it in other states as well, which is about investing dollars in preventing people from either coming in contact, or when they do come in contact with the justice system, actually preventing them coming in contact. I mean, we spend a huge amount of money on locking people up.
Yeah.
I think I read somewhere it's about $400,000 to lock up a juvenile, and I know it's $120,000 a year to lock up an adult. Imagine if we spent that much money on prevention.
Exactly. You could send everyone to uni for that amount of money. They'd all be living in mansions rather than a little cell.
Exactly. They'd be contributing to their families, to the economy. As in Australia, we would be a better place if we were, as you said, investing in scholarships for Aboriginal people rather than investing in jails.
It feels like we've said that. I mean, I'm sure these messages have been said by and cried out for by Aboriginal leaders over the generations. I mean, the evidence has been there for a very long time. You look at Justice Reinvestment, there's a wealth of evidence, and it almost seems logical that that would be the way forward. But I think it really does come back to that political will, doesn't it? It's just that real lack of want and to actually try and change these issues, regardless of all the government rhetoric. It just seems to come back to that lack of will, because the evidence is there, and black fellas have been crying out for this for a very long time.
Absolutely. I mean, again, you know, you've got a question, is policy made on evidence or is it made on ideology?
Yeah.
And I think when it comes to Aboriginal affairs, it's really clear that it's made on government ideology, at least in instances around justice.
Yeah, and And very much media-driven policy as well. I don't know if you're aware of the study, but University of Canberra just a couple of years ago did a study showing that Aboriginal affairs is one of the areas which is most sort of influenced by the media. And policy is just largely driven by what the media is saying. So it makes you realise the power that mainstream media in particular hold over the lives of Aboriginal people. It's very strong and nothing is changing as well. It makes me realise just how important the work that you guys are actually doing, because it is an area that's very media driven.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at the intervention, for example, there's been some research done, and I think it was the same mob that did that article, looking at the way the Northern Territory intervention was driven by the mainstream media and how they basically, for lack of a better word, bastardised the Sacred Little Children report and drew attention to things in ways that wasn't actually what was reported in that report. And we ended up with the fabulous intervention, which is locking up more Aboriginal young people now than what it was pre-intervention. Yeah. So the children that we were protecting when the intervention was brought in are the ones we're now locking up. So it's obviously not succeeded.
Yeah, no, it's incredibly disgraceful and disgusting, and I have a few choice words I can't say on radio either, but we'll go for a quick break and we'll be back after the program, and we'll ask our listeners how you can support what you're doing and where you can actually find a lot of your great articles. But we'll be back after the break with Summer Mae Finley.
This is Let's Talk with Amy McQuire.
Welcome back to Let's Talk. That was Carrie-Anne Cox with Beagle Bay Dreaming, and she's actually from Beagle Bay, which is on the Dampier Peninsula, over in WA, a really nice song there. And our guest this morning was Summer Mae Finley, and we were talking about the rising Indigenous incarceration crisis, but specifically how it affects the health of our people. And it's a really innovative project on behalf of CROKI, which is a social health, responsible health journalism, and it's a website. And we don't have much longer in the program, Summer, but I was wondering, how can people get involved with a lot of the work that you guys are doing?
Well, we're actually looking to finalise Just Justice soon and also put out an e-book. So there's a couple of ways. If you do work in the space or you want to share your story, get in contact with Melissa or myself on Twitter or through croaky.org. Alternatively, when the book comes out, use it. Promote it. If you're a teacher, use it. If you work in the sector, use it as an advocacy tool. But we really would also like your support through the articles that we're doing, by tweeting them, posting them on Facebook, or by, just reading them and sharing them with your friends. So, as I said, there's a few ways you can get involved. Contact us if you have a short story to share. Otherwise, just share our stories. That would be great.
What's your Twitter handles and how can people get in contact with you?
Yeah, so my Twitter handle is On Topic Oz. Melissa Sweet is CROKI Blog. But if you go to the CROKI website, which is croaky.org, you can also contact Melissa that way.
And will the ebook, you mentioned the ebook, will that be, how will that be available? Will it be up for sale or it'll be a free download?
We're going to make it a free download because basically we want to get the information out as far as wide as possible.
Yeah.
We think it's really important that, everybody have access to it, and we will be obviously promoting it through CROKI and other formats as well, but it will be free, and we're hoping to launch it sometime this year. We're working on a date. We've just got so many stories to publish. We just keep pushing it out a little bit. So.
I can imagine. And thank you so much for coming on the program today. I can imagine you're a very busy person. So it's really good to have you on chatting about these issues, and I really hope to get you on in the future as well.
Absolutely. I've had a ball talking to you today, and I'm always very passionate about our mob and our issues. So I'm very grateful that you've invited me on, and I'd be happy to come on again.
We'll definitely be happy to have you on. Thanks for that, and I hope you have a good rest of the week and a good, very happy Easter, and I hope you have a break as well.
I'm going to have a break for some of it, and same to you.
Thanks for that, Summer.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
That was Summer Mae Finley talking about Just Justice, a campaign through CROKI. And as she said, you can go to croaky.org. And we'll also put it up on our website. Our Facebook page is Facebook.com /letstalk, I think it is, or just Google 98.9 FM, the best country. We have a social media presence that we're trying to build. Tomorrow I'll be talking about Aboriginal campsites, and we're actually talking about the cultural heritage around Brisbane with a deadly author and historian who's actually pieced together a lot of the history around Brisbane, and it's a really fascinating history. The book's out just recently, and I was really interested to know about the suburbs I live. The suburbs around West End. He's talking a lot about Musgrave Park and the history of the camping grounds around that. It's a really fascinating book, and it's almost like a guidebook through Brisbane, a really important guidebook through Brisbane. So that's all we have time for today. We'll be back tomorrow. I really hope you have a great